The Mormon Expression Podcast is made possible through the support of our listeners. Consider making a donation or purchasing a subscription today at mormonexpression.com. The books you hear discussed on the podcast and others that we recommend can be purchased by clicking on the store link. And to those of you who have already contributed, thanks.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your guest host, Glenn. And a couple of weeks ago, John interviewed Tom Kimball and they discussed signature books and some of the upcoming publications that are coming out. Tom mentioned Steve Taysom is going to be putting out a Mormon Studies reader. And I know Steve. I've known Steve for several years. We lived in Bloomington together and made me think I need to get in touch with Steve and see if he'd be willing to come on the podcast and talk about the Mormon reader that he's putting together. And thankfully he was. So I'm here tonight with Steve Taysom. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Good. Doing great. It's good to talk to you again. It's been, we chat online every once in a while, but I don't think I've heard your voice probably for 4 or 5 years.
It's been a few years. Yeah, it has.
It's been a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why don't we start off, if you could just give us a little bit of background about yourself.
Sure. At the moment, I teach, and hopefully for the next few years anyway, I teach in the Religious Studies Department at Cleveland State. I did a BA in history at BYU and a master's and a PhD in religious studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. I'm married. I have 3 kids and 1 coming in the in March, I guess. And that's about as much of that's interesting about me as you're going to find, I think.
Yeah. What got you interested in Mormon studies? Why did you start down this path?
Well, like a lot of people who end up in religious studies, religion was a part of my life from a very young age. And I grew up, my father was a career Air Force officer and spent just short of 30 years in the Air Force. And so I was born in the Philippines and lived all over the world and went to high school in England and other places. And so my parents were these kind of old stock pioneer Mormons from Idaho who had left. And I was growing up in a kind of Mormon diaspora. So my experiences with the Mormon culture region were limited. And I kind of felt like an outsider when I would go visit family in the West. And so I always was interested in Mormonism as an object of study, even as a child. It was something that I could kind of conceive of in the abstract. And that, you know, propelled my interest. I was also very interested in history from a very young age. My parents were very interested in history and there were always lots of books around the house. And so in college I studied history and I just became drawn to religion, particularly as a cultural construction and the way human beings relate to the world through this set of symbols and rituals and texts that we sort of, this constellation of things we call religion.
Yeah. All right. Interesting. Okay. So you went to BYU, you studied history, and then you went to IU for graduate school. And what was the program that you were in here?
Religious studies.
Religious studies.
Yep.
And so what were the topics that kind of pulled you from history into a religious studies?
Well, I remember reading a book called Religion and the Decline of Magic by a guy named Keith Thomas when I was at BYU. And I remember thinking, you know, if I go into a history program, I can study religious history, but I also have to study lots of other things. If I go into a religious studies program, which has a historical track, I'm essentially doing the same thing, except I don't have to study everything else. I can just study the things like I was reading about in this book.
Yeah.
So essentially it was, that was what motivated it. I suppose at its heart. Yeah.
So when you came to IU, were you focused on studying religion in general, or did you have in your mind at that time that you were going to kind of narrow it down into your own religious culture and get into Mormon studies?
Well, I was definitely interested in religion in America.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, as you know, I don't know how familiar people are with graduate school, but one of the things, you know, you look for is not only the institution that you want to study at, but the person with whom you want to study. It's very important in picking a PhD program. And that person for me was a man by the name of Stephen Stein, who was and is one of the preeminent historians of religion in America. And so I knew that that's what I wanted to study. The question of what, you know, was it going to be Mormonism or not? I sort of suspected it was going to be, but I didn't show up with any kind of already set agenda about my dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know. And so I explored a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. And did you do a master's and a PhD? Was it a combined program or did you do them separately?
It was kind of a strange story. I had done 2 years of graduate school at BYU, the history department there.
All right.
And I left. I got accepted at IU into the PhD program, and I came, and they just said, well, you know, a lot of these credits will transfer. Just write a little thesis, and we'll give you a master's degree. So at the end of my first year, I took a paper that I'd written as a seminar paper and fleshed it out, and it became my master's thesis. And so I just sort of picked up the MA on the way to the PhD.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. And so was it Professor Stein then that encouraged you towards Mormon studies, or what was his opinion?
Stein mostly, and at first he was very interested in encouraging me to read outside of the 19th century, which was where my interests lie primarily. And so I did a lot of reading with him earlier than that and later than that. And I found out later that he was very interested to see how I approached Mormonism. Mm-hmm. And when he saw that it wasn't a devotional approach, that he was much more comfortable in having me write on Mormonism, particularly because it ended up being comparative study with his, one of his areas of expertise, which was the Shakers.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very encouraging of it. In fact, the whole reason I got into IU, I'm convinced, wasn't because of my stellar performance as an undergraduate, but it was because I took a course with a guy named Tom Alexander at BYU. And I was a senior there, and it said that advanced undergraduates could take graduate classes. And so I signed up as a senior to take a seminar from him. And I got through half the seminar before he realized I wasn't a graduate student. And so he was encouraging me to go to graduate school, and we were talking about where to go. And Stephen Stein had just happened to have written, I think, the foreword to the second edition of Alexander's book, Mormonism in Transition. And he spoke very highly of Stein, and I think spoke with him about me, and it sort of facilitated going there. So Stein certainly knew of my interest in Mormon studies and was encouraging it. But I think he wanted me to kind of look around a little bit. And he was, I think, evaluating me too.
Okay. And so your dissertation, is that what you turned into the book, about the Shakers?
Yes.
Shakers, Mormons, and Religious Worlds.
Yes, that's it. That's the expanded, new, improved version of that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to want to talk about that in a little bit. But first, let's unpack a little bit what you're doing now. So you're in your second year teaching.
Right.
And what are the courses that you currently teach?
Right at the moment, I'm teaching a course called The Rise of Modern Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
Which traces Jewish history from Middle Ages to the present. And I'm teaching my...
So that's not a euphemism for Mormonism, is it?
No, not at all. No, not modern Mormon Judaism.
Okay.
It's just the regular kind.
Because we are Ephraimites, you know.
So there's lots of complex issues between Mormons and Jews. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Right. And so then I teach my Intro to American Religion course. I also teach a course on religion and American culture that deals with pop culture. So lots of films and TV shows and readings about the theory of popular culture.
Yeah.
And a course on religion and the construction of evil. So it looks how religions construct systems of evil throughout time and cross-culturally, which is, of course, I really like. And then I teach the Religion 101 class, which is the introduction to the academic study of religion.
Yeah, I think you're kind of describing my my dream world, you know, from 5 or 6 years back. I would have loved it. You know, I taught my Folklore 101 classes. That was about as far as I got with it. And I do miss teaching, but my dissertation topic on Mormon humor was primarily so that I could, you know, once I got a job, construct a syllabus that taught humor, you know, the way that you're describing teaching pop culture. And, you know, what more fun can you have than sitting around talking about South Park and Seinfeld and, you know, pop culture with your students? It's a great excuse to show those videos in class, right?
Yeah, I mean, I have to struggle with the guilt that it, you know, accrues realizing they're paying me. I mean, they're paying me a lot, but they're paying.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, there was a kind of a sense when I, you know, the semesters when I teach that class of, am I really, you know, am I doing honest work here? Because it didn't feel like it. But there are other things about it that make it feel a little like.
So in your courses, when you cover Mormonism with your students, and I know you don't have any courses that are fully devoted to Mormonism, but it'll pop up from time to time. How do you handle your Mormon identity with your students? Do you let them know that you're a Mormon, or do you kind of keep that off the table?
I don't let them know. Typically, and I got this, you know, there are divisions in the profession about how one should handle this.
Uh-huh.
And so it isn't as if there is consensus about this.
Yeah.
I mean, some people advocate in print and in the classroom that there ought to be this sort of full disclosure.
Right.
But working with Stephen Stein at IU, he would handle it the way he handled it became essentially the model for the way I handle it,
mm-hmm.
which is when people ask me, you know, if they do, and surprisingly enough, they don't ask very often.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't happen very often that they ask me, you know, what do you believe? Because
yeah.
I think they're convinced I don't believe in anything,
right?
Which is kind of the point
of the
methodology. And he would simply say, if you can guess what I am at the end of the semester, I'll tell you. That's what he would tell students.
Okay.
And now, it wouldn't take them very long to figure out what I am. I mean, it, you know, they could Google me, and in, you know, 10 seconds they would know.
Right.
But most don't. And one of the reasons that I don't talk about it is it tends to be – it isn't that I'm afraid that they'll know or something,
yeah.
you know, and embarrass me. It's that it tends to shut them down a
right.
bit.
Right, right, right.
And they won't feel comfortable talking about some topics if they're afraid of offending me and then, you know, having it affect their grade. And so I'm very overt – at the very beginning of every semester to talk about what is religious studies and what isn't religious studies.
Yeah.
And so it isn't theology. And theology studies God. Religious studies people
mm-hmm.
and the things that they create. And so I make it clear there's no religious test. It doesn't matter what your affiliation is. We go into this discussion of bracketing, this kind of methodological idea that we set those things aside, our religious, you know, ideas and presuppositions so that we can all kind of meet on a level playing field without any sort of preconceived ideas of metaphysical truth. And most students understand that intuitively. They understand that it's a state university and that there is a wide range of diverse opinions and that you have to sort of bracket that off to have any kind of meaningful academic experience.
Yeah, I took a couple different approaches when I did that. I wasn't consistent from semester to semester, but I was always curious what to do with that Mormon identity. And more often than not, I would let them know up front. You know, I would go with that kind of full disclosure thing. But I was always concerned of how that might bias them if it did shut them down or made them concerned. So I tried to get into as much discussion as I could with them right up front so that they could see that I was kind of bulletproof.
Yeah.
You know, and I had one student just argue with me tooth and nail once that BYU students cannot drink Mountain Dew. And I said, well, you know, that's actually not true. He goes, no, I knew a guy. And I'm like, I was the guy. But
yeah, right. You know, like we physically can't do it, right?
Right,
it spills all over them.
It won't go down.
Right. Right.
It's that throat garment thing we've got. Yeah. All right. Interesting. So I think we've given a good overview. Our listeners have gotten a pretty good sense of who you are. But just to be clear, I've put together a little pop quiz.
Okay.
And I've got 10 kind of either or questions. You know, like I'll say chocolate or peanut butter, and you tell me.
Both.
Oh, come on. No, you can't do both. This isn't a Reese's commercial.
Oh, sorry. I have to go with chocolate.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got to pick one. All right. So I've got 10 of these.
Okay.
All right, number one. Lord of the Rings or Star Wars?
Star Wars.
Okay. Michael Scott or David Brent?
David.
Good choice. Okay. Paul McCartney or John Lennon?
Lennon.
Okay. Joseph Smith or Brigham Young?
Smith.
Okay. Cosmo Kramer or George Costanza?
Costanza.
Oh, I knew that one. Yeah, Book of Abraham or Book of Moses?
Moses.
Okay. You might have to unpack that one when we're done.
Okay.
Okay. The Old Testament, a literal word of God or socio-religious metaphor?
Socio-religious metaphor.
Yeah, I just made that up, by the way. I don't know if it's...
I was going to say the second one, but yeah. Okay. I think I'd show off a little bit and repeat what you said.
God's Army or the Singles Ward?
I have to pick one of those, huh? At God's Army, okay. All right.
Saturday's Warrior or My Turn on Earth?
My Turn on Earth.
Okay. And finally, John Larson or John DeLynn?
Oh, that's a loaded one.
It is.
Larson. Yeah, Larson.
Fantastic. We can continue now.
Okay.
We can go on.
I passed. All right, good.
Yeah. So tell me about the Book of Moses over the Book of Abraham. Because that was your only wrong answer.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, yeah, I will justify it to you then, I suppose. Or I'll just complain that the question was rigged.
Right.
My students like to do that. The Book of Moses, for me, contains, in Moses chapter 1, one of, I think, you know, a very beautiful kind of narrative that encapsulates much of what I've seen in lots of world religion literature. And I'm talking about particularly this encounter between Moses and this Satan figure.
Mm-hmm.
And the motif there is so important to so many systems of thought. And it's repeated very beautifully in Moses chapter 1. And so that's, for me, why Moses over Abraham. Abraham's interesting because of its sort of murky historical, you know, where did it come from? You know, what is it? Did it come from the papyrus? You know, did it not? Is it a cattle? You know, all that stuff. But for me, just in the sense of scripture, I think Moses is more appealing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Book of Abraham has pictures.
It does. Yeah, right. And those were always very fascinating to me as a child.
So that Satan motif, that's interesting. How does that compare to, you mentioned other religious cultural traditions. What is that? I mean, is that the evil trying to say, worship me as good, or?
Well, partially. It is partially that. It's partially this broader story of the unlikely hero that is, encounters the divine or something divine, is given information about who he is and information about reality and sort of ontological briefing. Then the sacred or the divine or whatever you want to call that withdraws itself. And this character is left to face a challenge in which he has to use the information that's been given to him,
mm-hmm.
or the object that's been given to him. And once he does that, he's able to move on and get more information. And so it's this kind of ascension motif. And it shows up in all kinds of literature. It's,
mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, it's got influences Hebraic literature. But it's also present in Zoroastrian materials and Egyptian materials. And it's in Star Wars, for example.
Right, right.
So it strikes me as being a very human way of reacting to reality. And so in that, I think it speaks to me.
Cool. Yeah, I'll go back and I'll read it again. I'll think of that. But that's good. All right. So let's talk a little bit about your dissertation that you turned into a book, and that Shakers, Mormons, and Religious Worlds: Conflicted Visions Contesting Boundaries.
Yeah.
If I'm inferring right, it was mainly Stein that got you interested in Shakers, or had you looked at Shakers before you came out to IU?
I was aware of the Shakers on some vague level.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was Stein had written the book, I mean, the book about the Shakers called The Shaker Experience in America. And, you know, it's this kind of encyclopedic thing. And
so for the listeners that don't know about the Shakers, just give a quick, you know, down and dirty overview who this group
of people were. Well, the Shakers, the history goes back to England, to Manchester, which was in the late 18th century, sort of industrial wasteland. And a woman named Anne Lee lives there, and she's influenced by some charismatic preachers that she meets who talk about celibacy, for example, and revelation. And she, in her early life, it's very vague. There's very, very few sources on her, but it appears that she lost some children. Mm-hmm. And she was placed in jail for disrupting church services in Manchester. And during one of her stays in jail, she claims that she saw a vision of Jesus and he told her to go to America. Mm-hmm. So they arrive, she and a few followers arrive in New York just before the American Revolution. So they kind of have to go underground because they're British pacifists, which doesn't look too good in New York in you know, period for the American Revolution. And after that, they sort of resurface again, and it grows. They practice celibacy, they live communally, and they believe that Anne Lee is a manifestation of this androgynous divine God, as Jesus was the male manifestation. And they sort of peak in the 1850s in terms of their membership, which was never very big. And there's one left now, actually.
Yeah, I just recently watched a documentary. Anybody that's interested, you can see it on Netflix. It's Ken Burns America, on the Shakers. And at the time he made that, there were two. I remember. So one of those has passed away.
Well, there. Yeah, and that was made, I think, in the 80s, and it went up from there. And so it's kind of gone up and down. When I started writing the book, there were four left. And I think, and actually in the print version of the book now, I think I mentioned four or three. Uh-huh. And now there's just one.
Yeah.
And this one lives in Sabbath Day Lake Village in Maine. Okay. Shakers lived in little villages.
Yeah.
First in New England and New York, and then they came to the West, they called it the Ohio River Valley, Indiana, and Ohio.
Yeah,
in 1805.
And the Shakers did exist alongside the Mormons, especially in the Kirtland area.
Yes, absolutely.
And there was some overlap and some membership. Some of the early members of the Mormons had been members of the Shakers. So, do you want to talk a little bit about that overlap there?
Yeah, I mean it's not as big as you would think. Mm-hmm. There was some overlap. And where I actually live in Shaker Heights used to be the North Union Shaker Village. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Shaker Heights is an eastern suburb of Cleveland. And further northeast is Kirtland. It's about 20 minutes up the road. And Shakers and Mormons were both appealing to the same kinds of individuals, people who were dissatisfied with the religions that had emerged after the Second Great Awakening. They were distressed by the kind of fighting going on in the rising evangelical mainstream, Baptists, Presbyterians, Methodists. And so both of them actually, I don't want to say poached, but attracted entire congregations that belonged to, for example, for the Mormons, the Campbellites, mm-hmm. you know, Sidney Rigdon's congregation in Kirtland joined almost wholesale. Yeah. The Shakers did the same thing with Presbyterians in Kentucky and Southern Ohio who were disaffected over controversies in that church. And so they were competing in that way by offering similar messages. Okay, so you had a prophetic figure, you had the belief in revelation, you had the sense of the end of time, you had the idea of an apostasy and a restoration. The notion that you're getting back to the true faith. And so it's
a very physical religious experience, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, they're called the Shakers for the when they would be overcome by the spirit and would.
Right. This sort of ecstatic dancing, which later on becomes institutionalized so that it's not as ecstatic if you were to go visit them in the 19th century as it would have if you visited them in, you know, 1790s. Mm-hmm. But so they're competing, and there is some overlap. And of course, that the section of the Doctrine and Covenants, and I can't remember off the top of my head which one it is, where the Shakers go. Or, I mean, the Mormons come here to the North Union Village and read the Revelation saying, you know, Anne-Lee is not God, and she's not Jesus, and, you know, you shouldn't be celibate and the rest of this. And the Shakers aren't interested. And so they kind of push them out. And there's not as much interaction as one might imagine. I mean, they kind of carve out their own worlds and sort of stay there, at least in terms of their relationships with each other.
Yeah. Fun fact, the first first presidency, Jesse Gauss, he was a Shaker.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. And I think he only stuck with the church maybe 6 months, maybe a year. You know, so much so that the revelation that was given to Jesse Gauss, they just scratched his name out.
That's and then right. Wrote, they did.
What was it? Frederick G. Williams was his replacement.
Right. And they did a lot of that with those revelations.
Right.
Edited, you know, quite freely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't want to spend too much time on your dissertation because we've got a long list of titles in your reader that I want to cover. But maybe if you could distill it down to just a couple of minutes, what do you feel like are the highlights of this your dissertation? What did it contribute to the academic community is what my advisor always that's what drove me out. I couldn't answer the question.
You have to package it that way, and then when you submit it, you get these anonymous reviewers saying, who the hell does this guy think he is?
Right.
Claiming all this wonderful original knowledge.
Yeah.
It's basically a fairly modest contribution. I take two sociological models of boundary maintenance, right? And that's just a fancy way of talking about the way that a minority religion relates to the culture, the broader culture of which it's a part. And when groups, in this case, religious groups, find themselves on the outside, they typically find ways to turn that to their advantage. Mm-hmm. And scholars have for a long time have talked about this, about, you know, there is this continuum of tension. From, you know, groups that are in no tension with their outside culture, you know, mainstream religions, to groups that are in extreme tension. And what I was arguing in the book is that even at the end, you know, higher tension end, there's another axis that talks about the quality of that tension, not just the quantity of it. And that if you look at the Mormons and you look at the Shakers, they have different models for how to deal with this tension. And so I look at the way the Shakers, because there are benefits to the tension and there are costs. And once the costs get too high, the Mormons tended to reevaluate their position, back off a little bit, and then reformulate the boundary while keeping the intellectual difference. So Zion, for example, this happens with the idea of Zion. It happens with polygamy. The Shakers are less able to do that. And so with celibacy, for example, when the costs of it get too high, and the cost of celibacy, the obvious one, is simply demographic. You don't, you know, have children. You don't have this growth, this kind of geometric increase. But there's also the kind of issue of acculturation. You know, if you have a child and it's born into a faith, you sort of get to acculturate this child from a very, very early age to thinking of this religious tradition as normative. Mm-hmm. And the Shakers don't have that either.
Right.
And so I actually discovered that in the 1840s, there was a debate going on in high level Shaker circles about possibly introducing a kind of limited celibacy. That is to say, you'd have a hierarchy of people. The very top would be celibate, but then the sort of pretty good but not really great ones would be able to have children occasionally. And this was shut down. And so the argument was that if you look at these two groups, you can see two separate approaches to boundary maintenance, and you see two very different outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. Well, that's Shakers, Mormons, and religious worlds, and we'll put that up on the website. We've got a store on MormonExpression.com, so we'll put a link up there. So anybody's interested in purchasing your book, we'll put up the link there for you.
Great.
All right. So in the time that we have left, it looks like there's about, 13, 15 essays that you have that you're going to be compiling into this Mormon Studies reader.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about the origins of this reader. How did it come about that you were going to be compiling this?
Okay, well, this is actually kind of an interesting story because I had submitted years ago when I was in, you know, my early years in graduate school, I had submitted to Signature Books. I sent them an email basically saying, you know, because they had a series of books that were readers basically, and they were heavily influential to me when I was thinking about Mormon studies when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, they hadn't done one in quite a while. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll submit something just to see if they're interested in a compilation. So that even a graduate student could do this. Right. Mm-hmm. And I sent them an email about it, and they expressed some interest and wrote back, and they said, just send us a table of contents. So I got a few things together and sent it in, and then I never heard anything from them. Mm-hmm. And that happens in, you know, in academic life, you know, that happens a lot. So yeah. I just forgot about it. And this had to be, I think, in 2003 or 2004 or something. Uh-huh. And then late last year, I got an email from Ron Prittis at Signature Books. And he said, are you still interested in doing this reader? And I couldn't remember. I said, yeah, I am, but you're going to have to send me the table of contents, because that was like two computers ago. And I couldn't remember. I mean, I really couldn't. I remembered a few of the articles that I had suggested. But, you know, it had sort of aged out of my mind by then. So many things had changed. And so at that point, they were expressed, and I still don't know how, have any idea how they resurrected it. I mean, it was in their files, and they just stumbled upon it or what. And so that's basically how I got involved with it.
Okay. And so at what stage are you in the process right now?
Right now, we're at the point where I've looked again at all the essays, and I'm sending them back to the authors to make small changes, particularly things that I think might need to be smoothed over a little bit for a non-academic audience. But these are very, very minor changes at this point. And then after that, it'll go to Ron Prittis at Signature for copy editing and that kind of stuff. And then and from there, it'll be published, I think, I would guess early next year.
Okay, so you're thinking sometime in the first quarter of 2011?
Yeah, I would think so. It was supposed to be this fall, but things got pushed back a little bit,
right,
because some other projects that they're working on, which are also very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's look down the list. So the first one that I have on my list, and this is in no particular order, but I've got The Forms and the Power, The Development of Mormon Ritual Healing to 1847 by Jonathan A. Stakely and Christine Wright.
Yeah.
Now, what can you tell us about this?
Okay. This is actually one that I was very, very excited to get for the reader. It's Jonathan Stapley, Chris Wright, and they actually have a series of these articles, and this is the early one, and it explores Joseph Smith's self-perception as a healer, and it ties the development of healing rituals within Mormonism to the development of the temple theologies, first in Kirtland and then in Nauvoo. And it discusses, for example, the use of apotropaic objects, or objects that ward off sickness or evil.
Say that word again. Apotropaic.
It's a nice Greek word. It's just used to describe something that can fend off evil. And so these objects, in this case, the evil of sickness, so handkerchiefs that could be blessed, the objects themselves were understood to have this kind of inherent power to heal once they were blessed. And also consecrated oil had a similar sense. So they would actually, you know, anoint with oil on the spot of the affliction, as if the oil itself carried with it the power to heal. Uh-huh. And this article deals with the institutionalization of ritual healing. So it moves from a time when there were very little rules about it to a much more formalized kind of sense. And this is interesting for, I think, lots of Latter-day Saints, because, you know, the healing ritual remains very prominent and part of our kind of liturgical repertoire. So, you know, the fact that most Mormon men carry this oil on their keychain. This is an essay that explores, you know, why that is, where it comes from. And most members of the church just have no idea.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Do you carry around oil on your keychain, Steve?
I do, actually.
Yeah, I stopped doing that a while ago. I think I probably still got some around here, but it goes rancid pretty quickly. You've got to exchange that out and put in some.
I just have a really, really tiny one, and there's very little in it. So it's, I don't like have a whole bottle on there or anything like some people do.
Yeah, right. Okay. So the next one I've got on here is Congenial to Almost Every Shade of Radicalism, The Delaware Valley and the Success of Early Mormonism by Stephen Fleming. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Stephen Fleming is a graduate student at UC Santa Barbara, and this is a micro study. In other words, it's looking at a very small group of Mormons in the Delaware Valley. And the question that he has, that he's asking, is why was Mormonism successful at that time in that place, in the 19th century? Mm. And he's challenging a whole body of historiographical literature that argues that people join certain kinds of religions because of their economic status. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the more deprived someone is, the more likely they are to go toward a kind of charismatic group. And he makes a very interesting argument, which is that Mormons in this time and at this place, at least, didn't share, or people who joined Mormonism didn't share an economic status, but they shared a worldview. Mm. And he argues that the Mormon belief that divine power was available and necessary was appealing to a certain kind of mindset, particularly Methodists and lapsed Quakers. And so it's an important contribution not only to Mormon studies particularly, but to the broader question of why do people join? What's the motive for conversion? And for very many years, it's been kind of an economic argument, and he's making a broader case for that.
And so he's focusing mainly on this geographical area, the Delaware Valley, not really delving into Canada, England, any of the other places where converts.
Right. I mean, it's kind of fine grained study.
Okay. Interesting. This next one, I just look at the title and I'm just so jealous of it already. But it's A Mormon Bigfoot, David Patton's Cain and the Conception of Evil in LDS Folklore by Matt Bowman.
Yeah, Matt Bowman is a graduate student at Georgetown.
Okay.
And a brilliant guy, most of the people who've contributed to this collection are. And this essay is kind of a famous one at this point, even now. It's been excerpted and published in other places. And this is a famous story in Mormonism, right? This idea that David Patton, he has this experience in the 1830s where he sees this, he's driving his wagon and he sees this huge, hairy, beastly creature walking on two legs. And I can't remember if he has a conversation with him or what it is, but something to the effect of, he's told later on that, yes, this was Cain, wandering.
Yeah.
This kind of liminal figure wandering around, can't really fit in with anybody, and he's this miserable figure. And Bowman takes that and looks at the fact that over time you have this emergence of the Bigfoot legend, sort of Sasquatch thing,
right,
and this conflation of the two in Mormon culture, saying that Cain is Bigfoot. And his argument is that this is evidence of the declining role of supernatural evil in the LDS worldview. And this is something that interests me on a professional level, because I'm also working on study of Mormon exorcism, history of Mormon exorcism and demonology, that I think would converse with this argument a little bit. But it's an important article because it has this really cool subject matter, but it's also important because he's drawing out these thematic strands and making an argument that's just broader than what the story itself tells. Mm-hmm. And this is something that hasn't happened a lot in Mormon studies. And it's something that a lot of these essays do. They link the particular Mormon story to something more broad, a kind of pattern, an intellectual pattern or construct. In this case, the idea of supernatural evil.
Yeah, I'm totally jealous. This is the sort of thing that I had thought that I'd be doing, and maybe if I want to take a stab at it, I'll explore the general authority Mick Jagger. Story,
that's a good one.
I don't think anybody's touched that one yet.
that one's
that's our modern day Bigfoot, big lips,
right? Like hell.
Cool. Okay. Next we've got Samuel Brown, the translator and the ghostwriter, Joseph Smith and W.W. Phelps.
Yeah. So Sam Brown's article, he's another one that's very new and doing a lot of important stuff. And he looks at some material that was written in the 1844 period. And he argues that Joseph Smith was using W.W. Phelps as a ghostwriter, particularly writing on political materials. And the more interesting part of the article is where he talks about the interest that Smith and Phelps shared in the idea of ancient languages, how they both liked to put forth this idea that they were in touch with esoteric language and biblical story. And so Phelps is often going off on these sort of bizarre linguistic tangents, which, Brown shows proven to be basically, wrong.
Yeah.
And that Joseph Smith was so enamored of this that he allowed these things to be written and then signed his name to them. Mm. And he talks a lot about the role of investing, something that's fairly common in the 19th century, but investing a lot of prestige and the ability to manipulate ancient languages and how important that was to Smith and to Phelps. And I think that's the real contribution to this art, of that article.
Interesting. Okay. Next one is The Private versus the Public, David O. McKay, Profile of a Complex Personality by Newell Bringhurst.
Yeah, I really like this article because it fleshes out McKay as a person. Now, this was written before the Gregory Prince biography of McKay, which is sort of the final word on the subject. But this article remains important because it goes to look at McKay's private life and how that life was shaped by McKay's experiences, but also how his private personality influenced his policy as president of the church. And so he talks about, McKay and how it was sometimes conflicting. So he talks about, McKay had a generally generous view of other people and wanted to make Mormonism inclusive and kind of have these wide arms. Mm. But that he also disliked confrontation. So he typically wouldn't fight with other members of the hierarchy over issues like blacks in the priesthood. Mm-hmm. And so even though that was something that he didn't apparently believe was inspired doctrine, he wouldn't work to change it because he did not relish the confrontation that would come from that. Brinkhurst also talks about McKay's doubts about Mormonism that he had that persisted into adulthood. Mm. And, he has a very interesting statement in there from one of McKay's sons, which said, "My father had two weaknesses. He drove too fast and he was vain." Mm. And it's not a kind of, trash piece where he's, digging up all this dirt. It's a very thoughtful exercise in looking at the humanity of somebody even as prominent and beloved as David McKay. And I think would be appealing to most people who see themselves, as full human beings. And we play roles at times, and we play our roles on Sunday, and we play our roles with our family, but all those things are part of who we are. And McKay certainly had strengths and weaknesses, and it all influenced his church presidency.
Well, it's too bad that he came before the 14 fundamentals of following the prophet, or he might have had an easier path ahead of him.
He may have, yeah. Yeah.
All right, the next one we have is Sex and Prophetic Power, a Comparison of John Humphrey Noyes, Founder of the Oneida Company with Joseph Smith Jr., the Mormon Prophet, by Lawrence Foster.
Yeah, Lawrence Foster is a professor at Georgia Tech. He's been writing on Mormon subjects for many years. He's not a member of the LDS Church.
Okay.
And did his PhD at the University of Chicago. And he's written a few books actually comparing Mormons, Shakers, and the Oneida community. So he's very well-versed in the kind of comparative enterprise. Mm-hmm. And in this article, he talks about the link between sexual impulses and religious impulses and how those things tend to be very closely related somehow. And he looks at the Oneida perfectionists and John Humphrey Noyes, and who was a contemporary his group was contemporary with Mormonism. He was, sort of around in the 1840s.
And where were they? Were they in Indiana?
No, they were in New York.
New York, okay.
They were in New York, yeah. They began in Vermont, and they ended up in New York. And they believed in, like the Shakers and the Mormons, they believed in an unusual or kind of countercultural sexual arrangement, family arrangement. And they believed in what they called complex marriage, which meant that all the people, the men and the women, were all married to one another, and they could engage in sexual relations with each other. But it was highly monitored, and they did not want to procreate. There were practices that kind of helped prevent that. But they were also involved in what they called stirpiculture, which was eugenics. And Noyes would select people to mate and have children based on their genetic characteristics. But Foster's argument is that it's, you know, you can view someone like Joseph Smith or someone like John Humphrey Noyes as being kind of hypersexual. And that's certainly not uncommon among religious people, religious leaders and charismatics in general. But he says once these leaders introduce these practices to a broader range of followers, then one has to ask deeper questions about what the purpose of it is. Mm-hmm. Because it can't just be that it's satisfying, you know, the prophetic figure's libido because they're allowing other people to participate. And so he's arguing that this behavior serves important sociological purposes, particularly in terms of binding the practitioners to this charismatic follower. And it's important because it's comparative. And there's unfortunately very little in the way of comparative studies in the field of, you know, Mormonism. And I think there's some interesting reasons for that. But.
Well, that'd be really interesting to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, D. Michael Quinn, plural marriage and Mormon fundamentalism.
Yeah, so Mike Quinn is something of a celebrity,
right,
in Mormon studies circles. Yeah. And this is an essay that I think is understudied. A lot of people don't know it. And I find it extremely fascinating, and it's very timely because, you know, you have Big Love, the series on HBO, and then this other series that was on for a few weeks on TLC about the guy with the, you know, called Sister Wives, I think, which was, you know, another group of Mormon fundamentalism. And Quinn looks at fundamentalism, Mormon fundamentalism, in all of its varieties. And he argues that it's, you know, it's a variegated kind of spectrum. I mean, it's not just one thing. And he looks at stereotypes that the Mormon fundamentalists have to deal with. And one of them that he talks about, interestingly enough, is the stereotype that all Mormon fundamentalist men are polygamists. And in fact, they're not.
Mm.
And he talks about that. He talks about stereotypes in terms of their dress, their appearance, where they live, how they live. And then he looks specifically at different groups and talks about their culture, talks about their, you know, their kind of rituals and their interactions and how they structure their lives, and additionally how the LDS Church uses them as a kind of ideologically oppositional straw man, and how they, you know, they downplay the number of polygamists, for example, and try to marginalize them in that way. And so it's really an interesting article to read. And like I said, very timely.
All right. Next one, we've got Martha Bradley, who wrote Building Community, the Fundamentalist Mormon Concept of Space.
Yeah, this is another one that deals with Mormon fundamentalism, particularly the FLDS Church that is headquartered down in Colorado City. This is the Warren Jeffs group. And this is a nice little article in which she makes links between the modern FLDS conceptions of space and Mormon ideas of space that date back to the 1830s. She's essentially arguing that they're preserving these Mormon ideas about space that have essentially fallen off the earth. You know, the other Mormon offshoot groups, the other, you know, people that share the Mormon kind of genealogy don't practice these anymore, don't believe in them anymore. But within the FLDS community, they're still there. And so it's not just the idea of sacred space and temples, which they obviously have, but also the idea of how you construct a city, you know, how the plat is supposed to look, where you put the agricultural space, all of those things, she argues, you know, if you want to find out where 1830s Mormonism is alive in that regard, it's in the FLDS Church. So it's another kind of fundamentalism. It's not just polygamy. It's kind of roots Mormonism in this conception of space also.
Okay. All right. Interesting. I feel like I keep saying that.
Yeah, no, it's everybody gets Well, that sounds boring.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Lame, next.
Right.
Okay. Let's say Mormon Studies in a European Setting by Douglas J. Davies.
Okay, this might be the most unusual piece in this. This originally was an introduction to another set of essays. And it's almost unheard of to put the introduction to another set of essays in a book of essays. But it was important, I thought, because it offers a kind of brief but engaging summary of some innovative and even daring work being done on Mormon studies topics by European scholars. And these, and so he's talking about papers that were being presented in Britain and in conferences held in Britain. And I think it's something that readers will come away, you know, they read it to come away with a greater sense of the important work being done in Mormonism in places far removed from the Mormon culture region. So that's really why I selected that for the piece. So it's required some editing, obviously,
right,
to kind of make it fit. But it's, and I couldn't include all those essays, but I could include Davies, who's a major figure in Mormon studies. He's an English, he's a professor at English University. And he does a very good job of introducing them and situating these scholars. And it's kind of a little convenient package for people to read and get a sense that it's just, it's well beyond where it once was.
So are they interested in different aspects of Mormonism in Europe than they would be?
I think they ask different kinds of questions.
Yeah.
And part of that is because they're thinking about it, obviously, from a different geographical perspective, yeah, but from a different kind of socialized perspective. I mean, they don't, you know, a lot of these people who are writing are going to be people who grew up in Mormon homes or are converts to the church. And people who are working on these problems in the United States are typically, you know, sixth, seventh, eighth generation Mormons. Mm-hmm. People who are working on them in Europe typically aren't. And so they're going to be asking different questions.
Okay. Interesting. There I go again.
Yeah.
Okay. The next one, this has always been, you know, when I was a kid, I loved this story about Wilford Woodruff's vision of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And,
right.
And so you've got an essay with that title by Brian H. Stuy. How do you say that?
I think it's Stuy, but I'm not sure. Stuy. I've never actually heard anybody say that.
S-T-U-Y, yeah. So what does he have to say about this, the vision of the signers of the Declaration of Independence?
Well, he says that, in fact, the work had already been done. Huh. By the time Wilford Woodruff has his vision.
Yeah.
He goes through and sort of traces. This is an older article. This came out, I think, around 2000 in that period. But it's such a good one that I had to put it in.
Right.
Because, yeah, you have this mythology of Woodruff talking about this experience that he had where the founders come to him and are kind of angrily demanding to know why he's not done his why he's not done the temple work for them.
Yeah.
And that they've been, you know, well, they want to know why they've been left in this sort of, you know, limbo state. And so, of course, he goes and does the work for them in the St. George Temple. And what this, you know, Stuy has done in this article is he looks at the historical record and finds that, in fact, this work had been done previously. It's most of it in the early 1870s. And so the question then becomes, the fact that we know that it's done, what does it mean that he had this experience? And the author argues that, you know, you could make the case that Woodruff was really talking about the fact that it was a dream, not necessarily a vision, and that this best, you know, reflects Woodruff's internal tensions about the need to have this done rather than an actual vision saying, you know, do it. So it's interesting. It's an interesting article in a couple of respects. One of them is just the fact that it had already been done.
Yeah,
but then the engagement with what does it mean when you have kind of religious claim on the one hand and then this counter evidence on the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, is it necessarily this kind of devastating idea that, well, it's obviously all not true and it's completely bogus. And he's much more nuanced than that. And I think it's very well done.
Now, I've never, you know, I've been familiar with this story since I was a kid, but I've never looked into the source material on it. So what was the context that this vision came out? Was this actually Wilford Woodruff, you know, wrote this and proclaimed this to people, or was it kind of secondhand, thirdhand?
Wilford Woodruff spoke about it.
Okay.
Sometime after.
Okay.
And so it was a first person, you know, account that Woodruff gave. You know,
that would be a memorat.
Is that what they, yeah, so the yeah, technical, cool. And yeah. Woodruff does this all the time.
Yeah.
In fact, in the book, the Mormons and Shaker book, I deal with, you know, there's a chapter in there about Mormon memory and its creation of the idea of Mormon foreknowledge of the West.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that there is basically zero reliable contemporary evidence to suggest Joseph Smith was talking specifically about moving to Utah and the Rocky Mountains, mm-hmm. even though that mythology is you know, all over the place in Utah.
Well, that's actually a great segue, Steve, because that's the next one on the list is Stephen Taysom's A Uniform and Common Recollection, Joseph Smith's Legacy, Polygamy, and the Creation of Mormon Public Memory. So that's what you're saying here?
Yeah, this – and – you know, Woodruff gives a talk, in the 1890s when he's very, very old about how Joseph Smith had told him that, you know, that there was a meeting in Kirtland and that, you know, the earth was, you know, that the church would grow to fill North and South America, would fill the world. It's a very famous quotation.
Right.
And then that the Mormons would go on to be a mighty people in the midst of the Rocky Mountains. Yeah. But if you look at Woodruff's journal in which he records everything, that meeting, you can find it. You can find he talks about the church filling North and South America and the world, but there's no mention at all of the Rocky Mountain prophecy. But so Woodruff has a history of doing that. I mean, he remembers things that he sort of misremembers them and mm-hmm. repeats them. And of course, within Mormon culture, once somebody in the hierarchy puts something on record, then that becomes the enough weight to sort of cite it as fact.
Yeah.
So then there isn't any real reason to look back and see if they're right, because the fact that they've said it is enough. And so that presents all kinds of interesting problems for historians.
So you cover that in your essay that's included in the collection as well.
I think I don't. I think that one actually shows up in the Mormon and Shaker book. The essay that I contributed is about Mormon memories of plural marriage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then there's one by Kathleen Flake that also deals with memory. Replacing memory, Latter-day Saint use of historical monuments and narrative in the early 20th century.
Yeah, this is one of the more complex and sophisticated pieces in the collection. Uh-huh. And she takes a concrete example of an event. She looks at a trip across the United States that was made by Joseph F. Smith and Reed Smoot and their respective parties. Reed Smoot was a senator. He'd been elected from the state of Utah. The Senate refused to seat him. Right. So there was this huge controversy. And in late 1905, they traveled across the country, Smoot and his party, to go and continue to contest this this issue of him being seated in the Senate. And Joseph F. Smith and his party to dedicate the monument in Vermont to Joseph Smith's birth. And she looks at the way in which this trip represents the changing emphasis in Mormon memory on certain events while others are being forgotten. Okay, so mm-hmm. Joseph Smith, the first vision, these kinds of things are being emphasized. Polygamy is being forgotten. Mm-hmm. And she uses that to kind of this moment to demonstrate the changes that are happening in Mormonism, the sort of massive watershed changes that are happening. And she draws on the work of Maurice Halbwachs to talk about collective memory and the power of memory. And it's basically the task that religious traditions have to engage in. And this is true cross-culturally and over time, that because religions exist in the world, in a place, in a time, in history, they're constantly having to change and innovate and adapt. But because the religions tend to make such broad truth claims and such exclusivist truth claims, they also have to simultaneously make it appear that they aren't changing. Mm. And one of the ways that that happens is through the manipulation of memory. Mm-hmm. And so Flake deals with that. And my essay in this collection was actually my master's thesis. Okay. And it came out right around the same time that the Flake article did. And it uses the same kind of theoretical underpinning as well.
Okay. You know, the monument that I'd like to see put up somewhere is the monument to the White Nephite Zelph. Or was he White Nephite? Or was, you know, he was a White Lamanite.
Lamanite, yeah. They found him in the burial mound. They dug him up. And
That was on Zion's camp, right, that they found him?
Yes, it was on the trip. They were kicking around and, you know, desecrating some graves and found him.
Yeah. We need to get that monument out there. start raising some money. Maybe somebody can come up with a good design.
Yeah, I could imagine a few, actually, off the top of my head.
Okay. we'll get to work on that.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, then we've got Brian Q. Cannon and Jacob W. Olmsted, Scandalous Film, The Campaign to Suppress Anti-Mormon Motion Pictures, 1911 to 1912.
This is another fun one. Brian Cannon, they're actually, Brian and Jake are both friends of mine. Brian teaches at BYU, and Jake is a graduate student in the history department at Texas Christian, I think. And this essay looks at particular anti-Mormon films produced in Scandinavia in 1911-1912 period, one of them called Victim of the Mormons. And it's a very standard kind of anti-Mormon film of the period. And this stuff goes back to like the Study in Scarlet, you know, the first Sherlock Holmes story about these Mormon missionaries who go to Europe and kidnap women to bring back to these harems, you know. And it's a similar story like that, very melodramatic. And the church was very concerned about it. And the essay talks about the fact that, you know, it talks about the church's reactions and trying to, you know, see what they could do about getting the film banned or whatever. But the most interesting thing about it is that it's this period, and it's the impact of this film and a couple others that they talk about. They had such a huge impact on Mormonism that in areas where these films were shown, there were declines in convert baptisms to the point of 25%, up to 25%. And what it told the Mormon leadership was that film is more powerful than print. And it was from this point, from 1912, and I think they mentioned, you know, one of the general conferences in 1912, I think it's David O. McKay stands up and you know, references this film, Victim of the Mormons, and says, clearly, film is better than print. And so the church says, we've got to get into the film business. And so it's that moment that launches the church into a field that continues to be a big deal with Mormons, with, you know, making these films.
So did they talk about some of the earliest Mormon films?
They don't talk much about that. Okay. That's sort of the ending point.
All right.
Where they say, you know, this is what it launched.
So they're setting up their career.
I think so, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, we got to get a DVD anthology with some of those early anti-Mormon motion pictures.
Yeah, I think if you could do that, that would be very, very interesting.
That would be amazing. Yeah. All right, cool. Just a few more. We've got Gary James Bergera, Buckeyes Laments, Two Early Insider Exposés of Mormon Polygamy and Their Authorship.
Yeah, this is – he looks at these poems, you know, Buckeye's Lamentation for Want of More Wives, and they're called. And it's a satire, and it appears in these poems appear in February of 1844 in a newspaper called the Warsaw Message in Illinois. And it's obviously an anti-Mormon piece. And Ruggiero looks at the authorship, and he identifies a potential author, which I won't tip off the I'll let you save that for the end of the article. But it's an important piece because it talks about – he uses these poems to look at this very turbid moment in Mormon history when you had former insiders becoming very virulent outsiders. And you had this sort of close group that was, you know, close to Joseph Smith and knew about plural marriage, was part of the Anointed Quorum, this early initiates into the Temple Endowment. And – they break with Smith primarily over the polygamy issue and become very outspoken critics. And he identifies one of these folks as the author of this poem. And it's a very clever way of looking at these dynamics through the lens of poetry.
So, and so did you say 1844?
1844.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Wow. I'd like to read that. Okay. Two more. We've got Reinhold R. Hill, God's Chosen People, Mormon Representations of Judaism and the Jewish Other in Holocaust Literature.
Yeah, this is one that looks at how Mormons have attempted to understand and relate to Jews. And Mormons have very interesting ideas about Jews and about their role in this kind of eschatological future.
Yeah.
And this sort of sense of relating to Jews. And one of the reasons is because, and you know, Hill points this out, that for Mormons, unlike most other Christian denominations, the Abrahamic covenant is still alive. And Mormons don't view that as kind of an abrogated thing. And most Christians view the Jews as the first chosen people who then, through their own, you know, hard-heartedness and blindness, sort of lost out on the covenant. That covenant's gone. A new one is here.
Yeah.
And Joseph Smith presents a very different kind of view where he says, you know, that, you know, the old covenant is the covenant. It's not going anyplace. It's just that it's being brought to other people so that it can get back around to the Jews. And Hill looks at a couple, an essay by Eugene England and an essay by Margaret Young, and looks at how they relate to Jews and Judaism, and particularly through the lens of the Holocaust. Mm. And he has some interesting critiques of the Mormon approach to Judaism. I think prove very interesting.
Yeah, I think back to when I was in high school, and I was probably a sophomore or a junior in high school, and found out that a friend of mine was Jewish, and I was really excited to share with him our connection.
Right.
And I just remember very clearly the bewildered look on his face as I was explaining to him that I was a member of the tribe of Ephraim and that he and I had a shared destiny together. And then I started realizing, you know, we've pretty much usurped their narrative, haven't we? I couldn't articulate it that way when I was in high school, but it's always stayed with me. So it sounds like that's right in line with these Mormon representations of Judaism.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, they're more sophisticated than that, I think. But
really?
His argument is you can't really understand these groups. You kind of have to leave it at an impasse.
Right.
You have to acknowledge that you can't really get inside the head of, and you know, for Judaism, that's kind of a big deal. This notion of uniqueness, particularly after the.
Okay, Preaching the Gospel of Church and Sex, Mormon Women's Fiction in the Young Women's Journal by Rebecca DeSchweinitz.
This piece, you know, she makes an interesting point, which and many people, contemporary Mormons, don't know this. But during the period before Utah gets statehood in 1896, Mormon women actually worked and had social lives that went well beyond the kind of domestic sphere. They didn't really buy into the majority Victorian American view of women in the home all the time. After, you know, statehood is achieved, then they kind of, Mormon views on this kind of start to assimilate, as they do with lots of other things, to a more mainstream American view. And so after 1896, you have this kind of restriction of women. DeSchweinitz is arguing is happening. Mm. And she looks at the fiction in this Young Women's Journal as a place where she can locate this tension between the old way of doing things that people still remember in this early 20th century period and the kind of new restrictions. And they are conflicted about it, and they're tense about it, and she finds a lot of very interesting things in this fiction that reflects that tension.
Okay, and then the last one on the list is Claudia Bushman, Edward Tullidge, and the Women of Mormondom. And I'm not familiar with that name, Edward Tullidge.
Edward Tullidge was a kind of gadfly figure. He joins the church in England and comes to Utah in 1861, and he seems a little unstable. He joins the Godbeite movement, which is this kind of offshoot movement challenging Brigham Young, and then eventually becomes a member of the RLDS Church. But he's an editor and an author, and he writes all kinds of books and articles about Mormonism. And one of the books that he writes is this Women of Mormondom book. And Bushman looks at this book and sort of it's really a celebratory piece of Tullidge. And she argues that he has managed in this essay, in this book rather, to preserve in written form this, what she calls this mystical and magical Zionic period, in which women more openly participated in religious life and the functions of Mormonism. And this is something that disappears, again, kind of after the manifesto and as Mormonism becomes American, and tamed and institutionalized. So she celebrates Tullidge because he's rediscovering this Zionic period for women, you know, this magical, mystical period in which they participated fully in religious life and ritual. And so she's arguing that he's a figure of that needs not to be ignored or kind of held in contempt, but rather appreciated for what he's done in preserving this memory of Mormon women.
Huh. Well, very cool. It sounds just like an amazing collection of essays, and so we can look forward to that sometime, let's say early 2011.
That's the plan.
And as you look at this and you kind of look across the field of Mormon studies, what do you see as the future direction? And I know that there's been kind of a resurgence. Well, I don't know if a resurgence, but like a growth in the last maybe 5 to 10 years in Mormon studies in the academia, if I'm right.
Yeah, there has been kind of targeted growth. That is, mm-hmm. there have been programs that have emerged at Utah State, for example, and what is UVU, Utah Valley University, that are religious studies programs with obviously heavy component Mormon studies. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're ever going to see probably any particularly strong institutional presence mm-hmm. like you do. I mean, you know, maybe in 1,000 years, you know, because now you have Catholic studies programs and you have Jewish studies programs.
Right.
That are pretty prominent in most large universities. But, you know, Mormon studies doesn't really exist in that way. Mm-hmm. And so I think what you're going to continue to see is what you see reflected in this reader, which is there will be academics who are working on other things who will work on Mormonism as well, or who are working on Mormonism but are you don't identify that way particularly. That is, they might be, you know, historians of American religion or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then you'll also have what we've always had in Mormon studies, which is this group of very vital, very bright, non-academic practitioners. A handful of the people who've written in this thing aren't, if they're academics, they're not academics in this field. Mm-hmm. And many of them aren't actually academics.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing other things. And so I think it will continue that way. I don't really see in the near future anyway some great dramatic rise in the institutional presence of Mormon studies in universities. But because Mormon studies has such a literate readership already built in, you see a huge, there's been a huge rise in the publication side of Mormonism at mainstream university presses, like Oxford University Press, for example. They publish lots and lots of Mormon titles now. And I think that has to do more with the audience than it does with the scholars themselves.
All right. So, you know, if we have people out there who are interested in getting involved in Mormon studies, maybe they'd like to model the Steve Taysom path to career greatness, what would you recommend for those people with an interest in pursuing Mormon studies?
Well, the first thing that you'd have to consider is, you know, if you want to be an academic, you know, if you want to do it that way, you have to really figure out if you're committed to do it, because the job market is very tight, and you go through, you know, you might spend, you know, in a history program or a religious studies program, 6 or 8 or 10 years post bachelor's degree, working on this stuff. And so you want to make sure that it's not just a hobby
mm-hmm.
and that it's sort of, and then if you find out it's something you really want to do, find somebody to work with. Get into a good graduate program, but then make sure you're touching lots of other bases when you think about Mormonism. Okay, you can't think about Mormonism as its own thing, cordoned off from everything else. So you need to think about Mormonism in the light of literary theory and comparative economics or comparative religion or comparative politics even, and put Mormonism in a conversation with other methodologies, with other bodies of source material, so that you're weaving a tapestry. The days of you know, Leonard Arrington, you just sort of locked yourself away and worked on Mormonism, I think are gone if they ever really existed. And so you have to be able to think more broadly than just, I want to be a Mormon studies scholar.
Okay. Well, thanks, Steve. It's been a fascinating hour. And then the way we always end this is to say the discussion continues over at MormonExpression.com. And don't forget to check out the store that we have there where you can purchase Steve's book on the Shakers and Mormons. And then in the next few months, once this reader becomes available, we'll put that up there as well. So thanks, Steve. Enjoy it.
Thank you, Glenn. Appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thanks, Steve. It's been a fascinating hour. Do you have any final words that you'd like to say? Boy, that sounded great.
Yeah, I know.
I feel like Chris Farley.
Yeah, the whole thing, all my responses sound kind of stupid, actually. But
okay. No. Oh, no. No. It sounds fascinating, actually.
Good.
It does, which is a different adjective than the one that I've been using. But, you know, it means the same
thing. Yeah, I feel a little bad about that, actually. I was hoping you'd
say that. Yeah, no.